Don't feel bad, Chuck. Peppermint Patty didn't mean all those things she said. Actually, she really likes you.
I don't feel bad for myself. I just feel bad because I ruined everyone's Thanksgiving.
But Thanksgiving is more than eating, Chuck. You heard what Linus was saying out there. Those early pilgrims were thankful for what had happened to them. And we should be thankful, too. We should just be thankful for being together. I think that's what they mean by Thanksgiving, Charlie Brown.
Hello, everybody. My name is Adam Shartoff. You're listening to Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 323. Well, we're going into the Thanksgiving holiday week, and I hope you have plans if that's something you want to do. I have one friend who says, no, not doing it. Don't like the whole thing. And, you know, this is somebody with friends who likes to hang out and have a party. So I don't know. I look at it just like a party with tryptophan thrown in. But so I kind of like it. But my family, interestingly enough, is kind of going through this period of transition, generationally speaking. Let's see. Well, back when I was growing up, my grandmother used to host it, and then it became like this thing where it was rotated among my grandmother and then my mom and her sister. So, the three families, a very matriarchal holiday, as you can tell. Grandparents, you know, of course, they got on, and then it became just my mom and her sister, and then my grandparents passed away some years ago. The additional thing about that whole holiday was it was always fell on the same week as my grandfather's birthday, so Thanksgiving was always with my mother's side of the family and the cousins and all that. So then for many decades, it seemed, or at least two or more, it's rotated between my mom and her sister. And then in the last few years, my mother has succumbed to Alzheimer's, so that's not an option anymore. And my aunt is fine, but, you know, it's just too much work. She's 80 years old. I could probably say that. She's not going to hear this podcast. And she's incredibly fit and very healthy. But, you know, it's just too much. And she also hosts a number of other holidays at her place, including Jewish holidays and this and that. So finally now we're starting to at least rotate it again to the next generation down, going out to Long Island to where my cousins are. And they're hosting this year, and they have a nice house and lots of kids now. So, you know, it's just kind of an odd thing because, you know, with people living so long, you're just kind of at my age, a middle-aged guy, perpetually young, you know, and you still want your grandparents around. I miss them to this day. But thank goodness that we have a big family. I mean, there's probably going to be 20 or more people. And my mom is going to be there too, which is nice. Even though she doesn't know anybody anymore, she will be there. That's my story. So now you know a little bit more about your host. Okay, let's go into episode number 323 of the podcast. The name of the show, again, is Film Wax Radio. So you know we probably wax about film. Waxing is technically, I guess you could say, talking and thinking and ruminating about something. And that's what we do. And it's about independent film, art film, you name it, festival films, and the industry of filmmaking as well. So that's what the show is about. If you're coming onto the show recently, and thank you for that, by the way. So what's going on? Okay, let's see. Well, this one particular segment fell into my lap, and it's going to be the first segment. It's with Zoe Lister-Jones, who is an actress you may remember from Breaking Upwards, and she was also played a role in the film Lola Versus. And interestingly enough, those two were directed by Daryl Ween, and I think I was calling him Wayne on the show, so beg your pardon, but I think it's pronounced Ween. Daryl's her husband and her filmmaking partner. They've now collaborated on a film. It's a dramatic feature. They've been doing comedies, quirky comedies, you know, with lots of romance in them. That's a romantic comedy, right? Yeah. So anyway, they've been doing these, and now they've decided now to take on a more dramatic subject matter. But here's the thing about why I was so excited to have them on. And by the way, I was going to have them on regardless. Now, I normally, you know, I would say, well, to the publicist that I arranged this with, I said, well, what's the date of theatrical release? And then she said, you know what? They're doing something very unconventional. They're releasing the film through Gather films and gather films, you know, gather, it provides the infrastructure for crowdsourcing screenings, meaning that a filmmaker can create an event and invite people through Gather, and if they get enough people, I guess they do the thing, you know. Or you, as somebody in your community, can decide to have a screening, and you can create it yourself. And you can go through the Gather library and find out more about it. But what was especially exciting about this is that I was also able to invite into the segment, besides Zoe Lister-Jones and besides Daryl Ween, I also invited on the CEO and the founder of Gather, Scott Glosserman. So this next segment, that we'll have all three of these people on the show. So we'll be able to talk about different ways of distributing and exhibiting your film, rather than always having to retrofit your theatrical into an existing model that may not serve you so well. In other words, we know the deal. You put your film in a theater, and it basically sits fairly dormant and quiet in the theater for the majority of days, unless you're very, very lucky. I'm talking about smaller films, by the way, smaller independent films. We're not talking about anything remotely like a studio film, or even for that matter, something that's a little bit larger, that's kind of has a pre-distribution built into it, you know, like a Wes Anderson film or a Coen Brothers film, anything like that, or Tarantino. I mean, those are actually big films. They're not going to have a trouble making their money back theatrically, I think. But these smaller films like Consumed, they will. So I was very excited to bring these guys on. What is the film about? Well, it does have this socio-political message about it in terms of GMOs. The film essentially is about a young woman who's trying to raise a small child by herself, basically, though they live with her mom, played by Zoe Lister-Jones, and her son starts getting sick, and she soon finds out that it's a result of his reaction to the foods that he's eating, which have lots of GMOs. They live around farm country where there is a lot of GMO seed farming going on. So this film is about that, and so with that message, of course, and really what the film is trying to do is get some social change to occur, meaning can these GMO products be labeled accordingly, and they're not currently in this country, and they are in many, many other countries. They label any food that has any kind of GMO ingredient, those products are labeled, but not in the United States, and that's wrong. There's a call to action with the film. It's true. It's not a documentary. We've seen lots of documentaries, including Food Inc. and others, that deal with this subject straight on in documentary format, but here we have a case where it is done in narrative a format, which is kind of nice and new. So bravo to them, and bravo to Gather as well for taking a shot at this. You can find out all you want to find out about the film Consumed by going to their website. It's consumedthemovie.com, and it will show you how you can attend a screening or even host a screening using Gather. Anyway, you can find everything out there is to find how to see the film and, of course, how to even host a screening yourself by going to the site consumedthemovie.com. Check it out. And we'll go in just a minute into my conversation with Zoe and with Daryl and with, again, Scott Glosserman, who is the CEO and founder of Gather, GATHR.com. And Zoe Lister-Jones is a wonderful actress, and Daryl Ween is a great filmmaker, and they're doing something very special and different. And it gets to the core of kind of what this show is about, which is what is best for a film? What is best for a filmmaker? And what is maybe most important of all, what is best for the filmgoer, right? What is your feeling about it? I got to create like a sort of some sort of poll type of functionality on my website to get people more engaged, because I really am curious, like, how much on a scale of 1 to 10 do you value going to a theater to see a movie versus the calm of your own home by yourself or with your, I don't know, who you're living with? You know, let's say it didn't matter how much the movie cost to you, or, you know, let's say it didn't even cost anything. What would you still prefer to do? Let me know. You can send in your information. Go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio, or you can Twitter. You can tweet me at filmwaxradio, either way. Or you can go to the website. There's an email function right on the homepage of that. Let me know what your thoughts are about that. Would you go to a theatrical if it wasn't an issue of the money? Or would you still prefer being at home and seeing it in the privacy of your own home? I'm pro-theater. And that's, of course, I come from a generation where I grew up that way. A lot of kids now are growing up in a very different way, and I understand it. But there's nothing more special to me than going to a theater in the right night when you're just in the mood for it. It happened the other day. I decided to go see a block of shorts at Doc NYC at the IFC Center, and it was fun, and I ran into people, and I went, and I sat, and I watched all these short films that I rarely get to do. I'm usually just so backed up as I am at the moment with needing to see feature films, so it was a nice thing. And then I ran up to the Bowtie Cinema on West 23rd Street in Manhattan, and no, I didn't go see another documentary. I went to see Mustang, which is currently in theaters, this Turkish independent film. It was fantastic. I loved it. At the end, all the cast came out. I ducked out shortly afterwards to go to a reception that was hosted by, or at least in part sponsored by HBO, because it was the talk was between John Alpert, who's been on the show, a documentary filmmaker, and Sheila Nevins, who is the producer of HBO documentaries. And I got to see them do the tail end of a talk and then went into the reception. It was a lot of, I saw more friends. What fun. But I got the theater experience and I got a party. It was fun. A good time. Speaking of documentaries, the second segment, I welcome back Bernardo Ruiz to the show. Bernardo was on episode 95 of the podcast when his last feature, it's called Reportero, was about to go on to POV on the PBS series, and Bernardo came on to talk about the film, and he's back now with a new film. It's called Kingdom of Shadows. It's currently also in theaters and focuses on three different people whose lives have been greatly affected by the drug trade between Mexico and the U.S. Some call it the drug war. I'm calling it a drug trade. Either way, it's a very violent and deadly situation where there are many, many disappeared, kidnapped or murdered or both. And the film is trying to, I know Bernardo's aim is to bring this information to you in a very cinematic way. Again, it's called Kingdom of Shadows, currently in select theaters and on demand right now. But let's now go first into my conversation with Daryl Wayne, Zoe Lister-Jones, and CEO of Gather, Scott Glosserman, and talking about their film, Consumed.
Hey, buddy. How was school?
Good.
What's going on with your arm?
Nothing.
Nobody can figure out where the rash is coming from, Tammy. Like, I just killed my baby.
We have created seeds that are able to withstand stress from the viruses, bacteria, adverse weather, soil conditions.
Clinestra has sued more than 800 family farms over patent infringement.
How do you patent life? I mean, honestly.
This university used to get most of its scientific funding from the USDA. Now it gets it from corporations, so we adjust.
This is science that's saving the world.
Now, almost 90% of corn and more than 90% of soybeans that are planted in the United States are genetically engineered.
So it's just in everything.
Does it sound okay, this volume?
It does.
Perfect, great.
Yeah. All right, so we'll just figure this out. We'll,
yeah, I'll pass the mic.
All right, so very excited to have you guys on. My goodness.
We are very excited.
Oh, you are? Well, okay, so let's see. I'll do all the introductions here. Zoe Lister-Jones is here, Daryl Wayne is here, and Scott Glosserman, CEO and founder of Gather. I was so glad. Thank you, by the way, to the publicists here at Sunshine Saks, because they kind of helped put this together. My first question, I think, was, well, what's the theatrical release? Because, you know, I want to time the release of this podcast, obviously, to help the film as much as I can. And they're doing something very unconventional, and they're going to go through Gather, and I understood once I saw the movie why. It's definitely kind of an issue-driven film, you could say. And then the VOD, and I thought, this is exactly what I want to talk about. So we have the film to talk about, but we also have the unique distribution.
Yes, we can talk about the movie and the release.
Cutting-edge distribution choices you're making. So let's start. The name of the movie is Consumed, starring Zoe Lister-Jones, coincidentally, who also co-wrote.
That's right, and produced.
And produced the film. Yeah. You had your hands full.
Yeah.
Daryl Wayne directed.
Yep.
And co-wrote and co-produced.
And co-produced, yes.
So this is really your baby. This is like...
It's another one of our babies that we're birthing into the world, yes. Every movie is like a baby.
Sure.
We've been together almost 12 years and we don't have children, but we do have three movie babies.
Four.
cheaper to put
through movie babies.
Cheaper to put through college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
Sort of. I'm not sure.
Well, you can look at this as like, you know, the sophomore film, freshman, sophomore, no, junior.
Well, Daryl made a documentary.
My first feature was a documentary called Sex Positive.
Oh, right.
Which was,
oh, okay. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it was about a gay S&M hustler in the 1980s that delves into the AIDS epidemic and safe sex. Totally different from Breaking Upwards, my first narrative movie, which was about a couple strategizing their own breakup, a la kind of Woody Allen.
Oh, I was there at the premiere. That means it might be where we met.
Yeah, that's
I
remember the party afterwards a little bit because it was at some restaurant club in the West Village.
Yes,
I have
a
weird memory. And do you know the most exciting thing other than seeing you guys? I was too shy to introduce myself at the time, but there was Andrew Martin at the bar. And I thought, oh, my God, all my friends are Canadian. Well, several of my friends are Canadians, and I thought this is going to be the ultimate picture. But, again, too shy to ask her to pose for a photo. But, and here's where it all ties together. Matthew Bonifacio again. His, I went to a film premiere of one of his films. It wasn't. It was Pounds, probably theatrical. Which, sorry, Scott. I apologize to Scott. He's he's waiting.
What are you talking about? I'm gripped. I'm totally entertained already.
And I actually even asked questions and let my subjects answer. But this is just, I guess, excitement. That I was at the premiere at the Lowe's or Village East, whatever. And who comes in
IFC
afterwards?
Center.
Was not there, but
oh,
it was. No, yours was, yes. Yeah. But there, the Matthews film was premiered at like the Village East on 2nd Avenue. And who walks in at the end of the screening but Andrew Martin? And this is just months after yours at that. And this time I was like, no, we're doing it. We're doing
your
it.
Picture?
We're actually engaged. No. Anyway. Consumed is the... So Consumed is the name of the film. Breaking Upwards and then also Lola Versus. And now this one.
Yeah.
And it's about... I could do it, but I'm already going to stop talking about GMOs and the risk factors farming.
Well, the movie's a dramatic thriller set in the controversial world of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. So it follows a Midwestern mother whose son comes down with a mysterious allergic reaction that she goes on a hunt to try and figure out what is causing it. And at the same time, we're following Danny Glover, who plays an organic farmer who is embroiled in a battle with a big biotech corporation over seed patent infringement. Mm-hmm. We follow Anthony Edwards and Kunal Nayar, two great actors.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Edwards from ER and Top Gun, and Kunal Nayar from Big Bang Theory, which it's fun to see him in a more dramatic role in this film as opposed to
zany goofy.
The comedy stuff that you'd normally see him in, which he's also great in. And they play two scientists who are on the brink of a major biotech discovery. And Victor Garber, who plays the CEO of a fictional biotech company. So it's kind of like an ensemble political thriller akin to Traffic or some of those 70s thrillers.
For sure.
Back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it definitely goes into that territory, as well as being just a personal film.
Yes.
Meaning that it's about it's also character-driven.
Yeah, I would say it's predominantly character-driven and... I think that's always important to us. A lot of people have asked me, this film is so different from Breaking Upwards and Lola Versus.
There's
no similarity, but I see a similarity in that it's kind of a war of words. You know, there's so many issues that we're trying to get at and tease out and layers to peel back. And this issue is of genetically modified organisms is so complicated. It's so vast. And I think a lot of people don't really understand how to penetrate it because it's just so convoluted. And so we try in the film to really distill it down in an accessible way and most importantly in an entertaining way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we could also talk for another whole segment just about the expectations of making a film that's like the other successes you've had, or you have a built in, like a, you know, there's the expectations of the audience to make another romantic comedy or something along those lines. And then you go off into this other direction, which is pretty striking.
GMOs are almost hilarious.
Yeah. I noticed he didn't have any musical numbers, which is very different also for a GMO story. But so, Zoe, why this? What was so compelling? I mean, you know.
Well, we started reading about GMOs like almost 8 years ago now, and I think we were both immediately really intrigued because it was something that we were learning was really pervasive in our food supply, but very few of us really could understand it. As Daryl had mentioned, it felt slightly impenetrable, and also there were all of these noir elements to the stories that we were reading about farmers and about the Corn Belt and about you know, big ag, and so we I think immediately saw potential there for a narrative storytelling rather than a documentary on the subject. Daryl and I have both been I think in our relationship, we've had sort of conflicting ideologies around food based on the way that we were raised. Daryl was raised eating a lot of processed food. I was raised eating mostly organics. And so I think...
Can you just say where you were raised?
I was raised in Connecticut.
And I was raised in Brooklyn.
The mean streets of what town?
The mean streets of Westport, Connecticut.
Westport.
Hard, gritty.
well, and I was, yeah, in you were, the you actual were in mean side? Streets of Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, that's right. You were...
So, yeah. So, I mean, sure. I think that food is generally a very personal and emotional subject for people. And so for us, it wasn't so much that we had made all these relationship comedies and then we were stepping out into something that was, you know, purely political. I think it was also personal. And I think it impacts people on a very emotional level, which is why we thought creating a character-based drama would be a really interesting foray into the subject.
All right, now to slowly transition a little bit to bring Scott into the conversation is the decision, because you realize you had a vehicle, maybe that's not the exact word, but you had this topic too that really was you could really be using the film as a way of getting this conversation going, obviously, right? So, which usually goes along with documentaries, as we know, and so this is not very typical to have like a narrative dramatic feature be crowdsourced.
In terms of the release.
Yeah, sort of a release instead of going theatrical. So let's talk about why you decided.
I'll do a little intro, set the stage for Scott to then talk a little bit further about Gather's overall model, but. Yeah, basically what we wanted to do was tap directly into our audience out there and try and creatively get the movie out to as many people as possible, which is hard to do when you're an independent film and you don't have a big studio behind you, you don't have a big production company behind you or big producers, and you know, to get your movie into a movie theater is a humongous mountain to climb in and of itself, but
and to penetrate how many films, like it's such a saturated market. So I think for a small indie, it's really difficult to stand out.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's always been a struggle. We've only made a few films, but you know, the typical traditional model of you put your film in a few cities in a theater and you have a very small, you know, for an independent film, usually you have a pretty small press and advertising budget, and it just becomes hard to get people to really see it. And so we thought, you know what, this movie is a movie that, sorry, there's crazy sirens outside. I hope we're not being drowned out here.
It's part of the score of my show.
Exactly.
It's verite in a way. I love it.
Exactly. They're coming after us right now. Anyway, so I think that our movie is about genetically modified organisms. It's set in the world of GMOs and food and tackles a lot of real world issues that we all face, that we all are, no pun intended, trying to digest every day of our lives. And so we thought, what better way to get this movie out than through Gather Films, which is almost as organic as the movement that we are kind of touching upon with this film, which has been a grassroots movement for decades. This movement of people that are trying to raise more awareness about healthy food in this country, about what it is we're eating and where it comes from. And so we thought, if we could do this theatrical on demand model where pretty much anybody in the country can sign up and either reserve a ticket to a screening that's already happening or host their own screening, it would just be so much such a better way for the film to really reach people. And so maybe Scott, who is the CEO of Gather, can just explain to people a little bit more about how that model works.
Gosh, it's so gratifying to hear you describe it that way. It makes every day that much more special.
Yes.
We have a model where imagine the Kickstarter for crowdsourcing critical masses of theatrical audiences. And imagine we've gone out and essentially optioned all the screens in the United States. And since we have these options on these screens, we know what all of the costs are. And so we're able to accommodate organic demand virtually wherever and whenever it exists. And when someone or some group wants to have a screening in some small town from Augusta to Anchorage, we know what that threshold is. We know how many tickets that person needs to reserve by pre-authorizing the credit cards to reserve the tickets in order for that screening to get a green light, to achieve critical mass. And if enough people reserve tickets, then the costs are covered. And the screening can happen with a crowd of like-minded people who share that same conviction to see the film or create social impact, political action, whatever it may be, a good discussion, awareness, or just a good time. And it becomes a found revenue for the theaters, these indie theaters that are trying to survive and get butts in seats during the week, for instance. It's great. It's so gratifying for filmmakers to have a screening in a far-flung place like Oklahoma City or Albuquerque or Beaumont, Texas. And so because we're able to accommodate organic demand, the films that gravitate towards this model are the ones that have a emotionally charged issue, whether they're features or whether they're docs. If they've got a community that they can access through the coalition building of wonderful supporting organizations, for instance, Consume has partnered with the Just Label It campaign, which is such a worthy organization that's trying to put labeling on foods, genetic GMO labeling. They have an extensive community all over the country. And what are you going to do with all of those leads? How do you activate that community if you don't have a cost-effective way of accommodating the demand when they want to screen it? And so if we can do that through theatrical on demand, that makes all of these wonderful organization partnerships worthwhile. And all of the labor and effort, they've been spending 7 years coalition building with organizations and bloggers and journalists so that we can activate that whole, we've indirectly amassed that community, and they can all be in play, as it were, because of this bottom-up model.
It's a mouthful. No, that's great. It seems like at some point the system is retrofitting, you know, constantly retrofitting to, you know, the filmmakers rather are trying to retrofit to accommodate this infrastructure, which no longer serves them or audiences, which ends up in like you said, Scott, a lot of empty seats in theaters Sunday through Thursday, frankly. And so it's this is a great model, you know. So it's glad to see you guys are really, you know, taking some. I mean, it sounds like risks, but to me, I think it's a bigger risk to just try to take your movie and put it in a theater when you know it's going to be empty more or less for 5. Even if you're a local and like here in New York and filmmakers, and you're you put it in a or, you know, if you get it into a theater for a week, knowing full well that a majority of that week it's going to sit, you know, in spare
room.
Right,
and you just hope that people show up. I mean, that's what's so cool about about partnering Consumed with Gather is that it's we created perfect. A call to action video, which people can go see at consumethemovie.com, and it explains exactly how the release is working.
Yeah.
And it is such a more user-friendly experience. And through social media, people can follow on Facebook and Twitter. We set up events for screenings on Facebook in each city. And it creates a community event around each screening. So people can really, who normally wouldn't come together or know that they're sitting next to a person that cares about the same issues in the theater, they get to be there for these special one-night screenings and really engage together around a story that they all feel passionate about.
You can still send out the press release and invite the press. Like if you're doing a Gather screening in New York, and we want to get press around the screening because we're trying to make an impact on food labeling on GMO products, let's say, for instance. This is a legitimate way.
Absolutely. And any movie captain in any city that's promoting the film to their friends and their supporters and their audience base, they can also attract local press, as we just did actually with Consumed in Champaign, Illinois, which is where we shot the movie. It was amazing. The local newspapers there did a few articles on the film and how we shot it there and how we were releasing it with Gather. And
sold out.
Yeah, sold out. We sold out the first screening in 3 hours, like over 200 people, and it actually just happened last night, which was.
And the second screening did another 150 people.
Yeah, I think, and it grew to over 200
actually,
last night.
Actually, if you combine the tickets that they sold at the theater, I think it was 200 as well. So we had two full screenings just through this organic.
Exactly. On a Tuesday night in Champaign, Illinois, which it's hard to get that kind of volume from a movie. Yeah, in a suburb of.
What's even more special about this concept is that when you have a screening on a Tuesday night in Champaign and you're at a multiplex, there's probably four other people across 20 screens. And so when 200, well, now a combined 400 people show up on a Tuesday night in this small town. I mean, that is the event. You're going to spill into the lobby and talk about it for 30 minutes, take it home with you. There's an opportunity to create a real call to action and some real social impact there. And there's so much about using a film, as you said earlier, as a vehicle to really galvanize a local community around social impact or political action. And that happens through a perception of value when people go out and spend capital on marketing efforts. If you look what Hunting Grounds is doing right now in anticipation of its CNN release. But it also deals with granular impact. One screening in Champaign, Illinois can create just as much, if not more, significance when people actually get together in a kinetic environment and discuss those issues and formulate a plan of action.
But not to mistake, the film works as a
movie.
As an entertainment.
Exactly.
We don't want to get
in the beginning.
It's
a
tension there. It's a fine line to walk as filmmakers, right? Because you have to keep in mind these things, the commercial life cycle or life of a film.
I think Daryl mentioned the political thrillers of the 70s that were an inspiration to us, where I think the issues could be at the forefront while the films could still be, you know, entertaining stories that were character driven. And so I think that was, as you said, it is a fine line, but I think we were excited to not water down the real world issues and weave them into an engaging storyline with characters that people could, you know, relate to and wanted to follow their arcs.
And that shows both sides of the GMO argument. You know, Victor Garber, who plays the CEO the fictional biotech company in the film, we humanize his struggle and his story and show how he is trying to promote genetically modified foods to the world. So
he's not just twirling his mustache.
That's right. No, he's not just twirling his mustache.
Usually they are.
Right, exactly. And so we were trying to, you know, do something a little bit different than the norm there. But straddling that line of politics and suspense is always a tricky line to walk. But I hope people find it gratifying.
The fact that the film is such an entertaining thriller is a testament to the filmmakers. It's so gratifying to us as its distributor, because we are oftentimes dealing with very worthy documentaries, which are a challenge even to coalition build around, because NGOs and organizations are getting flogged all the time with documentaries. To be able to bring a feature, a dramatization, a narrative, and an entertaining one to these orgs to build that base is terrific. But this stands on its own as a wonderful film. And when the base comes out, they just add more credibility. When I say the base, I mean people who may not be passionate enough about film to get babysitters on a Wednesday night. If those people are coming out and creating credibility for that film and standing by it, that's only going to create the larger concentric circles of interest and demand for a film like this.
I was just imagining all those people at the theaters eating the popcorn now. You know,
there is an irony there.
Yeah. I do want to discuss one scene, because as I'm a parent, I have an 11-year-old, and you know, there's this really effective scene where Zoe, your character, what's her name?
Sophie,
is walking in the supermarket aisle. Talking about a thrill. This might be the scariest moment in the film, ironically, where she's realizing in this paranoiac way, but it's not really paranoia, how dangerous these products are that are just sitting there innocently on the shelves. But it's true. I have this experience, maybe not on the scale, but right. Like when I'm walking in the supermarket, you think you're, you know, when you're thinking about feeding your child.
It's
hit home, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I'm glad. I mean, yeah. I'm glad and I'm not glad, but I think that was really important for us
parents,
as filmmakers. Yeah. Is I think, To root the story in a single mother as our protagonist, mm-hmm. I think was intentional in that way. I think that so many parents are really confused and overwhelmed by the amount of contradictory information that they're being, you know, exposed to, and who to trust in terms of food safety and what to buy for their children, what to feed their families, is hugely overwhelming and can incite some paranoia and hysteria. And so I think to play into the fears that parents are facing these days was important in terms of the storytelling, but also in terms of the real world impact.
Just to follow up on that, there's currently no way for you to know if you're eating GMOs, because the foods aren't labeled with labels. So the only way you really can avoid them is if you're eating something that is organic,
certified.
US, yeah, organic, right. Certified with that stamp of approval, or with the non-GMO project verified label on it. And so, you know, that in and of itself is kind of alarming, you know, and it was one of the things that kind of got us interested from the beginning, that over 80% of the food we eat has genetically modified ingredients in it, and just nobody really knows it. I mean, it's just crazy that 64 countries around the world label or ban GMOs, but the United States does not.
Yeah.
So it's I think, you know, some of the underlying political undertones of the film that are getting at these real world issues are really important and universal to all of us, because we're all eating this food. And I think Zoe and I, in real life, as people, really just believe that there needs to be more information disseminated about what, you know, what is the impact that they're having on the environment and us, and why aren't there long-term studies being done on them?
Well, so the name of the film again is Consumed. You can go to Consume the Movie.
ConsumeTheMovie.com, and we're at Consume Movie on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, and you can go to the website and click on See the Film, and that will bring you to the Gather page, where you can see a map and you can enter your city and you can find a screening anywhere in America, or you can host a request
thing.
A screening.
It's a powerful tool. And Scott, if you could just... also, just if you're some other filmmaker and they're interested in what you're doing, what's the best way to go about it?
If you are a filmmaker and you have a film that you feel has has themes running through it to whom highly emotionally engaged communities with passions for commitment to the issues are interested. That's the type of film where an organic model such as ours could really help. If you're interested in that, you can contact us through Gather, through either emailing support@gather.us, or just go to the website, gather.us. No E in no Gather. E.
No. And also, not just filmmakers, but if you want to host a movie screening, you know, you can also check out gather.us.
The best place to go is to the consumed site, because there you can learn so much about the film.
Yeah.
And you can also find out where it's probably already playing, where you are, and all you have to do is reserve a ticket or purchase a ticket if the screening's happening. And as Daryl says, if there isn't one in your area, then you can decide if you want to champion a screening yourself, which is a super gratifying thing to do.
Host a film, as somebody who hosts films myself, but put me out of work, sure. I mean, it's not, I'm not going to retire off that. So no, it's great.
Too.
Yeah, right.
Come on, let's do more stuff together.
We could do the Daryl Wayne Zoe Lister Jones retrospective too. And then on demand, is that?
Yes, the movie will be released in March
on next March.
iTunes and Netflix and VOD and all of the digital platforms.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But before then, we're focusing
on this. So we
create
maybe
a groundswell of.
I mean, not even put that in for now, because.
No, people should know down the line that.
Well,
that
I also do. I mean, I kind of do my best afterwards also to keep people in touch and support through social media. I'm not going to have it back on. No, I'm kidding around.
Oh, we can't do a follow-up?
No. Absolutely can, actually, truthfully. I'd be happy for that. Well, thanks, everybody. Thank you. If you go to the website takepart.com/kingdom-of-shadows, or you can Google Kingdom of Shadows and it'll come up first in your results, and that will take you to the film, and you can find out details about Bernardo Ruiz's film. It's always nice to have somebody back on the podcast. I was really big on getting Bernardo back, and I was very set in doing this, and I'm glad we were able to pull it off. Again, you can go back to episode number 95. I think they work nicely together, and I'm going to try to be better at returning guests, letting you know what other episodes they've been on in case you kind of want to hear more about them or from them. Anyway, so here's my conversation with filmmaker Bernardo Ruiz talking about his new documentary, Kingdom of Shadows.
What really kicked off my undercover career in federal law enforcement was picking up phones from loads that we had intercepted at the border. Rather than just let the phone sit there, you know, they would start calling and say, hey, did you make it? Ya llegaste, ¿dónde estás? And I would actually talk to the individual we had just arrested. And I would just talk to him to see how he would talk. And I would try to mimic how he would talk. I would ask him, like, hey, you know, where are you from? Where are you going? What? And this is all within, you know, 5 minutes of us taking the load down. The guy would call. I'd be like, ¿dónde estás? And they'd be like, well, where are you? And I hit him back like, wow, you know, I got nervous. You know, the Border Patrol was behind me, but I was able to get away. But where are you guys at? So I would show up, and then I would start calling, and I'd see who was the ones that are answering the phone. And we would arrest that load, and then we would play with those phones.
Hey, man.
How are you?
Good, good. Just been busy. Just thankfully. It's just been a really strong tour. So just on the kind of final leg of it, I'm going to do D.C., going to Duke to the Documentary Center's conference. They're doing a big film 25-year anniversary conference. And then I'm headed off to IDFA for a bunch of screenings for the European premiere, and we're doing 5 screenings in Amsterdam.
Wow. And what about in Mexico?
So we actually already did the release in Mexico. It's through Mantaraya, which is an art house distributor. Mm-hmm. Any kind of like European art house films or some of the Mexican art house titles all go through Mantaraya. So we did a pretty, for a documentary, I think we did a pretty big release. It's 5 cities throughout Mexico in Cineplexes through Monterrey. So, yeah, so I'm pretty excited about that. And
When was the Mexican theatrical? When was that?
November 6th was the release in Mexico. So it hit Mexico first. Here in the States, it's November 20th. And then obviously, like, the VOD services being, like, the big, you know.
Sure.
Probably that's where everybody's going to actually see it.
Remind me when Reportero came out, remind me that festival in Mexico that it was such a...
That was 2012. And that was Ambulante. Gael Garcia and Diego Luna started that festival. So we did 12 cities through Ambulante. And that was, you know, it was a really, ended up having a very long life. It was interesting. Like, I had no real publicists to speak of throughout the life of the thing, but it had a great life.
You know, re-listening, if that's a word, to our first podcast we did back in 2013. I believe it was January 2013. And I was reminded when I was listening to it that I actually participated in a screening of Reportero at the Brooklyn Museum. I mean, I now remember very clearly. But.
That's right. That's right. We did that great screening at the Brooklyn Museum. I forgot about that.
That those were, you know, because that was a tough series because, you know, the Brooklyn Museum, obviously, nobody really knows that there are screenings there, that they have this great theater. Yeah, if I remember, you had a very engaged, good turnout.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I think a lot of students came out for that one. But it was great to screen at the Brooklyn Museum.
Well, let's get talking about Kingdom of Shadows because that is, of course, upon us. And also, this is a kind of a, in a way, not to oversimplify it, but it's a kind of expands on the themes in Reportero in the sense that it's also about the fallout of drug trafficking in Mexico, and also in how it affects both Americans, North Americans rather, and Central Americans, both sides of the border, and focuses sort of on three different subjects, three different characters, three different people caught up in the story, and it really humanizes the story as a result. But first, give a little of the backstory in terms of it's very interesting how participant media got involved, and then there was some filmmakers who had a personal stake in this, really liked your filmmaking, right? And inspired their film. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean it was the whole experience has been a kind of fascinating one. I mean, I think you're right in a way that this film is a follow up to Reportero. I mean, Reportero was really this kind of labor of love. It was 2.5 years of production and, you know, sometimes a year at least of research before then, following journalists who were covering organized crime and political corruption in Baja and, you know, northern Mexico. But along the way, I had begun to collect these other stories, and in particular, hearing about the issue of disappearances, and that's people being abducted in Mexico and, you know, vanishing without a trace.
We think of Chile. We think of Chile in the 70s and 80s, you know, that when you went in Pinochet, Chile.
Exactly, exactly. That's another kind of major point of reference when people use that term. And, you know, we, at least until a few years ago, I didn't really hear a lot of people talking about it in, you know, in terms of with regards to the drug war. The drug war just has seemed like a kind of chaotic and violent set of skirmishes, but not the same kind of state-sponsored violence that we had in Chile and Argentina, as you mentioned, or in the Southern Cone countries. But, you know, as I started to finish Reportero, I started to hearing about enforced disappearances, and those are disappearances where state security forces are involved in the abduction of innocents of people. So I, not always, you know, innocent, but for the, you know, a large part of them certainly are. So anyway, I wanted to tell a story in that kind of, they could shed some light on that issue. And I heard about Sister Consuelo, who's this extremely dynamic nun and human rights defender in the city of Monterrey. So basically I was interested in that story. And as I was kind of thinking about these issues, got in touch with me, and they had this kind of interesting proposition. They had partnered with Mexican producers who, as you mentioned, had a personal stake in this issue. My producer, Jimena Martí, her younger brother had been kidnapped in 2008. And, you know, despite her family, which is a family of means in Mexico, despite them paying a very, you know, large ransom, the boy was never returned. And a few weeks after the ransom was paid, his body was discovered in the trunk of a car in Mexico City. And, you know, that really prompted them to reflect on kind of their position in Mexico. You know, their thinking was, look, we're very wealthy and we're very well connected. They had the then president's ear. And they thought, you know, if this is happening to us, what does this mean for ordinary citizens, for everyday folks who just don't have those same resources or connections? And so they partnered with Participant, and, you know, Participant, in large part because a reportero came to me and said, you know, is this something that you would you be interested in working on a film that addresses the U.S. Mexico narco conflict? And I had already been thinking about some of these stories. And so it ended up that there was a kind of unusual alignment of goals, and we kind of set off on this path of making a film together.
For those who don't know, maybe listening, the Participant Media is a organization, right? They help to finance and to launch projects. I don't know. They're not a production company, or are they a production company as well? I don't know.
You know, they're a studio. They're kind of like a mini studio. So they both produce and they acquire and they distribute in some cases. And they do have this, their fiction side where they produce narrative features.
Yeah.
And then they also have their documentary side. And, you know, I knew that as a documentarian, I knew them from their documentary films, you know, films like Food Inc. and An Inconvenient Truth The Cove.
Yeah.
You know, they have been known for making these kind of big, splashy documentaries. And
The films have to have a social, positive social message.
That's right. They're usually taking on a kind of, you know, an urgent social issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, this is, I at least thought it was unusual that they would, A, that they would seek me out, because I'm kind of more interested in projects that blend journalism and cinema. You know, I don't necessarily see myself as a social issue filmmaker. I certainly take those issues on, but I think more and more in terms of journalism and documentary and independent cinema than I do kind of social issue filmmaking.
Well, I suppose that's true, and I know from a personal place what you're talking about, but from a viewer standpoint, or more, we're seeing somebody who's talking about First Amendment, and like, you know, in terms of what we might call it here in the States, of freedom of speech,
freedom
to practice journalism, and freedom of personal safety. These are basic fundamental rights in this country and in Mexico, but they're not, unfortunately, because of the corrupt governments, I guess, and all sorts of systemic problems. It's not in practice, especially in the north part of the country.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that there are certain regions about Mexico where those kind of basic rights are not respected. But, you know, in terms of the film, I was just surprised because this is a smaller film by Participant standards. And, you know, I think a tough film in some ways because it's a triptych. It's three different stories. It's kind of a fragmented narrative. You know, we're jumping around, hopscotching from location to location and jumping in time from, you know, from the 80s at the height of the Just Say No era in Don Henry Ford's story to a kind of more contemporary story with Sister Consuelo, who's this nun and human rights defender. The whole thing was an unusual partnership with Participant that's, you know, ultimately yielded, I think, a really great working relationship. But I think for everyone involved in the beginning, there was a, you know, question about how it would all work.
Well, a lot of very popular films in the mainstream now are playing around with time. You know, my point is that American audiences are a little bit more sophisticated. I think they're ready for, you know, a documentary along the lines of Kingdom of Shadows. But I just wanted to let also people know you made a reference to Don Ford, one of the three subjects that you are following. And he was a former drug trafficker, an American who would go down to Mexico and bring marijuana back up to the States, correct? I guess a mule.
You know. That's right. And he, you know, more than a mule.
Not really a mule. Yeah, you're right.
But no, he was a mule as well. I mean, he basically became a trafficker in the 80s, you know, in the lead up to the Just Say No era under Reagan, when you could do business with, according to him, with different organized crime groups. But kind of at the pinnacle of his smuggling, he worked for the Juarez cartel, the kind of notorious Juarez cartel. and actually met Amado Carrillo Fuentes and did some work for him. And Amado Carrillo Fuentes is, you know, considered by many to be one of the kind of biggest capos, biggest drug bosses of his era, to the point where there's now plenty of telenovelas that have been there's a big one now called Señor de los Cielos, or Lord of the Skies, that's based on his, you know, very loosely based on his story. But so, you know, it was fascinating to find this guy who wittingly or unwittingly did some smuggling, you know, got involved in a very serious organized crime group in the 1980s. I mean, he ultimately served 5 years, which is a very short sentence for the type of work that he did. But for, you know, for being apprehended while trying to import marijuana into the United States, into I believe it was New Mexico at the time. But anyway, so he, you know, he's just one of the three characters, and I think fascinating to me because, in a way, I think, I don't think we've seen many stories either in fiction or in documentary that show the U.S. side of the kind of drug smuggling business as it relates to the Mexican cartels. And certainly, you know, Don challenges some of the basic stereotypes of who's doing the smuggling. I think to a lot of people, he looks like the classic, you know, rugged American cowboy, like a John Wayne figure, when in fact he was a smuggler. And, you know, all of the characters in this film do, you know, all play with stereotypes, all kind of challenge the easy characterizations.
Bernardo, where did the title Kingdom of Shadows come from?
You know, now going on 4 or 5 years that I've spent time on this topic, organized crime and the underworld. And anytime you do research in this space, you come across the word shadows, you know, whether it's a shadow business or activities that take place in the shadows. And I started to think that the kind of three people who are in this film, they're all residents of a third country that's neither Mexico nor the United States. It's this place that's been marked by trauma and loss, and it's its own country. It's all, you know, it's like a country of shadows. And I finally chose Kingdom because Sister Consuelo, who is, her work is so rooted in her faith. In my conversations with her, she would frequently bring up the term, you know, the Kingdom of Heaven. In Spanish, you'd say it's el reino de, you know, de Dios, or, you know, Kingdom of God. And so I just wanted to take it out of the regional, and I also didn't want such a blunt and frontal title, like such an obvious title. I think that, the narco or cartel are titles that are, you know, they're effective in grabbing audiences, but I think they're kind of ham-fisted and blunt. And so I wanted something that pointed towards a kind of different vision around the story.
Well, now that you mention it, I guess the mainstream media is as full of references and shows and films as ever when it comes to the drug war, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Netflix, you know, just the second season of Narcos was just announced recently, and there's Sicario. And on the documentary side, obviously, there's Cartel Land. You know, there's, I think, we're in a moment where this kind of media around the subject matter abounds. And I think, you know, at least on the documentary side, I think it's good that we're having, you know, ideally we're having better conversations around this issue. I mean, obviously, you know, Hollywood and fiction are designed, you know, principally as entertainment. Their goal isn't necessarily to inform, you know, so that's really kind of, that's a separate issue. Documentary side, I think that what I try to do in my work is to dig a little deeper and to show a kind of different side of the conflict. I think that they're kind of, again, there's a way to kind of attempt to tell the story in a frontal way. Oftentimes for me, those kind of stories fall short. And I also think that they certainly don't provide any context. And for me, you know, when it comes to this story, I feel like it's a little bit like staring at the sun. You know, when you're talking about organized crime, you know, it is like staring at the sun in the sense that you can't do it for very long. You certainly can't do it in such a straight way. But what you can do is look at how that phenomenon has impacted people and communities and different things. And so that's part of what I try to do in Kingdom of Shadows, is to show how three people from three very different walks of life have all been impacted by this conflict and how their lives have been changed by this conflict.
I guess after all these, the last at least 5 years, it seems like you've been working on this particular theme. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about in terms of your next project, if you're thinking of anything at all at this stage, because there's still much to do with this project.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're kind of halfway through presenting Kingdom Shadows to the public, you know, in terms of here in the States and then internationally, and then there's a digital platforms. Oh, it's going on VOD. We should mention, it's a good place, Zenny, to say, by the way, that you're going to be having your theatrical here in New York and San Diego, Los Angeles?
That's right, L.A. and Minneapolis as well, interestingly. Yeah.
And on demand, we can kind of make more of a focus on the actual, you know, theatrical, I suppose. But that's all happening this Friday.
That's right.
The 20th.
No, and it's really exciting that it's, you know, that the film is going to have this limited theatrical here in the U.S. and then a kind of bigger push on all the video on demand services, you know, iTunes and Google Play and Amazon and Hulu.
You're saturating everything, man.
What'd you say?
You're saturating everything.
I mean, as much as a, you know, small foreign language documentary or, you know, partially foreign language documentary can saturate anything, it's definitely getting a nice push from participant. They've been great in terms of kind of pushing the film. You know, I think that it's, you know, this film has also been like a bit of a slow burn. You know, it's been more of a kind of tortoise than a hare, but it's slowly building an audience. And as reviews are starting to come in, I think people are getting that this is it's a different look or a different way into a story that we've all heard about or we think we know about, with a few surprises along the way. And it is, you know, unfortunately, it is this topic that's a kind of endless topic. I don't think any one of us who report on or do documentary work on the narco conflict think it's going to end anytime soon. But I do think that we need work that is kind of rooted in better journalism. I'm increasingly working more and more closely with investigative journalists on my work, on my films, because I think as, you know, audience appetites for documentary are growing. I think that actually production value is arguably going up in a lot of documentaries. We're seeing more production, bigger production budgets than we used to see a few years ago. I think there isn't a concurrent emphasis on journalism and research. I think there's a lot of stuff that looks real pretty, but doesn't have much in the way of substance. So that would be my argument anyway. And so what I'm very interested in doing is doing work that kind of marries journalism and cinema, but that's rooted in well-researched and, you know, and vetted kind of topics. And so the next project, that's a long way of getting to your answer, but the next project that I've started is, you know, in part touches on the narco conflict. It's about conflict in general. And I'm looking at a kind of fresh way to tell that story. You know, I've raised a little bit of money already, so I'm down that path against my wishes sometimes. You know, I think there's part of me that would rather do a food and wine documentary, but
you have time for that. You're a young man.
Not that young.
Bernardo, thank you. The film again is called Kingdom of Shadows. It's going to premiere in New York City and in Los Angeles and San Diego and Minneapolis. Excuse me, Minneapolis. Let's not forget our friends up in the Midwest theatrically. So go see it. If you're nowhere near there, yeah, it's playing on digital platforms as well, beginning November 20th. And it's great to have you back on. People can listen to episode 95, which is a very early episode that you were on, and get the full Bernardo Ruiz experience. And then go see the movies, of course.
Excellent. Adam, thank you so much. Always good to talk to you.
Same here.
Talk soon.
Again, everybody, I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. You know, engage with me. Facebook, we already said, facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. You got Twitter, @FilmWaxRadio. We're on, have our website, FilmWaxRadio.com has all sorts of information there and ways of engaging with me and with the show. Please do write in. I keep in touch with almost everybody as quickly as I can. It's not always easy, but I really do value your knowing you're out there and listening. I would really love it if you were subscribed if you're not already. I don't know exactly how you're listening to the show specifically, but if you are not an iTunes subscriber, please consider doing that. It's very simple. Just go to the iTunes store and, of course, search FilmWax or FilmWax Radio. It'll come right up. Select the button, and then it'll show you the whole backlog of available shows on our archive, and you can subscribe right there, and you can also leave a star rating, very important, and also a comment if you have a minute or two just to plug that in. Let me know what you think of the show. It's very helpful. I recently had somebody write in. He says, I love Adam's show. I'm giving him 4 out of 5 stars. I'd give him a 5th star, except I don't think he has enough guests of color on the show. And I was so, you know, embarrassed in a certain way about myself, but so grateful for this guy to write in and be honest about his feelings about that. You know, I feel like I do a fair to middling job of bringing on people of color. I don't think I'm bad at it. I think it's just really I could do much better. And if you are somebody who cares, and I hope you are, about getting a fair representation, a diverse group a guest list, then I applaud that. And please keep me to task. If you feel like I'm not doing right by you, let me know. I think constructive criticism is very helpful, and I appreciate that criticism, in fact, because it is something I do think about and I care about very much so. And so thank you for that. We'll be back in about a week or so, right after the holiday weekend, with a brand new episode of FilmWax Radio. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Until then, take care.
You know, everything is not an anecdote. You have to discriminate. You choose things that are funny or mildly amusing or interesting. You're a miracle. Your stories have none of that. They're not even amusing accidentally. Honey, I'd like you to meet Del Griffith. He's got some amusing anecdotes for you. Oh, and here's a gun so you can blow your brains out. You'll thank me for it. I could tolerate any insurance seminar. For days, I could sit there and listen to them go on and on with a big smile on my face. And I'd say, how can you stand it? And I'd say, because I've been with Del Griffith. I can take anything. And you know what they'd say? They'd say, I know what you mean. The shower curtain ring guy. Whoa. It's like going on a date with a chatty Kathy doll. I expect you to have a little string on your chest, you know, that I pull out and have to snap back. Except I wouldn't pull it out and snap it back. You would. And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
You want to hurt me? Go right ahead if it makes you feel any better. I'm an easy target. Yeah, you're right. I talk too much. I also listen too much. I could be a cold-hearted cynic like you. But I don't like to hurt people's feelings. Well, you think what you want about me. I'm not changing. I like me. My wife likes me. My customers like me. Because I'm the real article. What you see is what you get.